It's the 8th of April 2011, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Is it a happy first birthday to the Digital Economy Act, or will his parents be wishing that they had bought it whilst they still had the chance? Are Japan's earthquake-hit nuclear plants really dangerous, or should we be more worried about attacks from giant monsters? Will A.C. Grayling's secular Bible preach to the converted, or the unconverted? Why did the American Humanist Association award a prize to someone who wrote 36 Reasons for the Existence of God? Is donating your body to medical science any use, or do you just become part of a somewhat creepy puppet show? And how do you horrify the entire internet without doing a goatsy? But first, do we need to rewrite the laws of physics, and if so, will it require a referendum? We're going to ease you into this week's show with some hardcore particle physics. Apparently, scientists looking at subatomic particles have found something unusual. No, they haven't managed to find evidence of Nick Clegg's principles, but arguably something even stranger than that. It could even be a whole new subatomic particle. And if what this paper suggests is true, this could completely rewrite what is known as the standard model of particle physics. And the building blocks of life as we know it will come crumbling down. So enjoy gravity while we still have it. Who knows whether it will still exist tomorrow. Here's Sean Ellis, being slightly less sensational than me.
Isaac Asimov once said, "The most exciting phrase to hear in science, the one that heralds new discoveries, is not Eureka, but rather, that's funny." The guys at Fermilab apparently agree. On Wednesday, they published a paper, with nearly 400 authors no less, which presents some preliminary findings that are firmly in the that's funny category. To explain, we need to back up a bit. Fermilab is a particle accelerator that fires beams of protons and antiprotons at each other at very high energies to create new subatomic particles. Most of these are extremely short-lived and decay in such tiny fractions of a second that they don't make it to the detectors. Their presence is betrayed only by their decay products. Proton-antiproton collisions are messy, however, as each proton is a bundle of three quarks and sundry gluons and things which hold the quarks together. Sifting meaning out of the hundreds of particles that appear as collision products is a painstaking process. This is the job of the Collider Detector at Fermilab team. The CDF team were looking at a particular class of event where a W particle, a massive force-carrying particle, appears along with two jets of assorted other particles. The physics of how the W and other particles behaves is well understood, according to the so-called standard model, and this allowed the CDF team to predict how many events of this type they should see, with particular energies. This agreed quite nicely with the actual observations, until they got to an energy of about 140 gigaelectron volts. For reference, if you allow proton and antiproton to annihilate, their mass is converted into about 1 gigaelectron volt each, so this is a pretty high energy collision. Anyway, at this point, there were slightly more events than predicted. After removing any events which might be problematic, giving false positives, and subtracting out all of the known processes that might produce these events, the CDF team were left with a stubborn excess. These formed a roughly bell-shaped curve centred somewhere between 140 and 150 gigaelectron volts. This kind of feature is known as a resonance in particle physics circles, and usually signifies the presence of a particle. The position of the peak indicates the mass of the particle, and the narrower the peak, the longer lived the particle is. The resonance peak they discovered corresponds to no known particle, nor to one which has been predicted by the standard model. That's definitely funny. Now, these are preliminary results, so there are two possibilities we must first consider before predicting the death of the standard model of particle physics. First, is it just a fluke? The number of events is low. Not that low, but observing more excess events in this energy range will firm up the error bars and reduce the chances that it's some kind of statistical fluke. Second, are the numerical models correct? The CDF team used multiple different pieces of software to model different background processes. An error in one of these could possibly explain the discrepancy. But if on further investigation this resonance does turn out to be real, what is it? The CDF team have already looked at other kinds of events to see if the expected signal from the predicted Higgs particle appears at this energy. It appears that it does not, so they say it's unlikely that they found the Higgs. What other exotica could it be? A pentaquark is one possibility, a bound state of four quarks and an antiquark, but theoretical models for these don't really predict that this will hold together at all, so it hardly counts as a particle. Also, my admittedly imperfect grasp of particle physics leads me to suspect that this would result in something much messier than a two-jet decay. That's usually the sign of a much simpler system. Could it be a new lepton? There are three versions of the electron. The electron itself, the muon, and the Tor particle, each more heavy than the last, and the standard model is quite happy with just three. A new, super-heavy fourth lepton would be upsetting, but would at least stretch the standard model rather than breaking it. A new quark? No. The top quark's already heavier than this, so we would have found it already. Supersymmetry? This extension to the standard model predicts new particles related to the existing particles, with specific properties, but again initial analysis suggests that at least some of these can be ruled out. This is again based on the makeup of the jets and the absence of a signal in other kinds of events. So, for now, the jury is out. If it's a fluke, then we've learned something useful about our models and measurement techniques. But if not, then it opens up particle physics and transforms from something funny to something wonderful. This is Sean Ellis at the Subatomic Scale for the Pod Delusion.
If you're listening to this podcast on the day of release, today, the 8th of April, marks the first birthday of the Digital Economy Act. It follows an awkward pregnancy in which the fetus, known as the Digital Economy Bill, caused no end of controversy and ended in an awkward rushed caesarean birth during the last-minute legislative wash-up prior to the last general election. So let's check in 1 year on and see how little Digital Economy Act is getting on. Has he managed to cut off his first internet pirate yet? Or is he still at that stage where he's pooing everywhere and no one really wants to go near him? Here's James Firth with more.
It's Friday the 8th of April, and it's exactly 1 year since the Queen gave her royal assent to the Digital Economy Act. Rushed through in the dying days of the last Parliament, with support from the Conservatives, then in opposition, they could have killed the bill by blocking its speedy passage, but I doubt they savoured the prospect of picking up the pieces should they take office after the election, as they did. On this, the first anniversary of the UK's anti-file sharing control measures, I thought it worth taking a look at how the new law has taken effect. The last 365 days have seen exactly no one disconnected for sharing copyrighted content, precisely no websites blocked, and zero warning letters issued. That's because the relevant portions of the Act are a clusterfuck. The rushed, naive legislation that hasn't yet taken force for reasons I'll get into in a bit. In fact, it's a wonder that the Conservative-led government is still pushing the case for this Act, since the Culture Secretary Jeremy Hunt described it in Parliament 363 days ago like this. In short, we could have had a proper digital economy bill. We wanted an iPod, but we got an Amstrad. Music industry lobbyists prowling the corridors of power have ensured that the Act remains a government priority. I don't say this lightly. I've been participating in roundtable debates in Parliament and witnessed the lobbying firsthand. Of course, I can't grumble about lobbying since my own involvement has made me, well, a lobbyist. An unpaid citizen lobbyist. So what's holding up the measures to track file sharers, warn them of infringement, introduce technical measures that could include slowing or blocking net access for those warned three times, and increase the likelihood that rights holders will start suing repeat infringers? Firstly, there are severe delays drawing up the code of practice, known as the Initial Obligations Code, that will dictate how internet service providers and groups representing copyright holders will detect and react to copyright infringing activity. How any appeals process will work is widely acknowledged as a bone of contention, and contacts close to the process have told me groups representing public bodies such as schools, colleges and libraries have strongly objected to earlier drafts of the code since it didn't make special exemptions for public bodies like libraries and universities that offer shared internet access as part of a provision of a public service. I attended a meeting at the British Library last year to discuss issues facing so-called public intermediaries. The meeting heard how systems to safeguard universities alone against measures in the Act could cost between 24 and 56 million in the first 3 years alone, depending on how appeals are to be handled. All the issues facing public intermediaries apply equally to private companies offering shared internet access. From employers to cafe and hotel owners, anyone who lets anyone else use their internet connection risks ultimate disconnection if it gets used for unlawful file sharing. A second serious problem facing the Act is a judicial challenge brought by BT and TalkTalk over compatibility with European law. Laws that are designed to allow competition between telecom service providers throughout the EU and a few pesky rules providing for data protection and privacy in accordance with the Convention on Human Rights. The complex legal issues are things I've been blogging about in earnest for the last year or so. If you want to know more, you can find me via the Pod Delusion blog. Suffice to say, there's some serious and heavyweight opposition to the Digital Economy Act. The outcome of the judicial review is not expected for a few months, but I'm fairly sure, whatever the result, it will be contested. If the review results in legislation being struck down, there will no doubt be a chorus of protest defending the sovereignty of Parliament and denouncing any mandate for unelected judges to block the will of the elected Parliament. It's worth noting the fallacy in this argument right now, since judges do have a mandate to untangle conflicts in law. The review judge is simply looking at the potential for one UK law to conflict with other UK laws. But it so happens that the other existing laws enact EU legislation, so the course of the legal process could include a trip to the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg. Going back to the will of the elected Parliament, it's worth also noting the Video Recordings Act 1984 was discovered to be faulty 25 years later in 2009 after officials uncovered another snafu over compliance with an EU directive. So again, the will of the elected being overridden this time by civil servants. Either way, it could take over a year to complete this round of litigation. And even then, there is nothing to prevent a second review to be ordered on the initial obligations code once completed. But groups representing copyright holders have a plan B. Censorship. Yes, plans are actually afoot for a nationwide voluntary censorship system to be implemented by all the main internet service providers. Voluntary means ISPs are not required by law to implement, not that it's optional for ISP customers. And voluntary is such a vague term, as I'm sure certain incentives or disincentives might ride on compliance with this new scheme. The scratch plans involve a new central agency to compile and manage the list of websites to be censored, with the aim that all participating ISPs will block exactly the same sites, thereby preventing customers switching to a rival in order to freeload the latest Rebecca Black single. I've never advocated breaking the law. I think copyright needs reforming, as the software industry is starting to highlight that strong copyright protection can inhibit technological innovation, just as it can inhibit inventive reuse of music and video in the world of mashups. I mention the software industry because in many respects it's brought matters to a head, when each and every building block can be protected for 70 years beyond the death of the person to first code it, irrespective of the concept of inventive step that's key to patent laws. I'm no fan of software patents either, but at least patent protection is limited to just 20 years. I'm fighting the Digital Economy Act for its absurdity in not recognising the knowledge economy paradox. Innovation can be threatened if ideas are strongly protected, yet economic growth can be hit if ideas can't be traded. I'm also fighting the trampling of basic human rights in the process of enforcing minor civil laws. Now we're adding a national censorship system into the mix, I'm wondering how long it will take for sanity to prevail. Will the digital economy we all strive to achieve be lost to foreign competitors who adopt a more pragmatic approach to rights protection, better attuned to the digital age? I'm Citizen Lobbyist Firth, reporting for the Pod Delusion.
So they say that all publicity is good publicity, and apparently this is nowhere more true than in the nuclear energy industry. The recent earthquake in Japan, which caused several reactors to go, and I'm told this is a technical term, tits up, has not led to people saying we should use less nuclear power, but has actually led to a lot of people defending its safety record. Perhaps the most remarkable U-turn was the arch-environmentalist George Monbiot. In the space of a few weeks, he went from being a member of the anti-nuclear lobby to an enthusiastic proponent of nuclear power, and even started slagging off his former colleagues. To put this in some perspective, it's basically the equivalent of Melanie Phillips converting to Islam or Baroness Worsley saying something that isn't actually completely bollocks. But how safe is nuclear power? What has the disaster in Japan taught us? Here's Drew Ray with more.
Attention, everyone. This is an emergency broadcast. Anyone who has watched monster movies from the 1950s knows the formula. Radiation plus Japan equals giant monster.
Godzilla.
Rodan.
The creature from the Black Lagoon.
Gojira.
And coming in 2011, the news coverage of Fukushima. On the 11th of March 2011, a 9.0 magnitude earthquake occurred off the coast of Honshu. The earthquake caused immediate shutdown of the 4 reactors at the Fukushima 2 nuclear plant and the 3 reactors which were operating at the Fukushima 1 nuclear plant. Nuclear fuel rods continue to generate heat even after a sustained fission reaction has stopped. The heat generated decreases during the days after shutdown, but never stops entirely. This means that the reactor must be cooled even after shutdown, and the fuel rods must be stored in a way that allows excess heat to be removed. At Fukushima 1, cooling after shutdown requires an external power supply, and the spent fuel rods are stored in pools of water. The tsunami following the earthquake damaged both the external power links into the plant and the backup generators. The backup to the backup was battery power, and this worked as planned. Unfortunately, due in large part to the widespread disruption to Fukushima Prefecture caused by the earthquake and tsunami, power could not be restored before the batteries ran down. Without cooling, the reactors began to heat up again. This had several effects, the worst being damage to the fuel rods and the cooling system itself, and the need to release hydrogen gas to relieve pressure. It was this hydrogen gas exploding which caused damage to the buildings around the reactor containment vessels. At no time was there a risk of a nuclear explosion, or even a runaway nuclear reaction. As far as we know, the only workers killed were those immediately drowned or crushed by the earthquake and tsunami. The workers most affected were actually standing in radioactive water. And if all of the most severe measured doses were experienced by a single individual, that person would have received the same amount of extra radiation as if they'd been living for 10 years far away from any nuclear reactor. In other words, Fukushima has spectacularly failed to earn a place on the list of major industrial accidents. On a risk matrix, the severity of the accident would probably be recorded as marginal. Here's a quick list of some accidents that have made it to the Industrial Accident Hall of Fame. The Union Carbide plant at Bhopal killed 20,000 people and permanently injured several hundred thousand. The explosion of Piper Alpha killed 167 workers. The 2010 Connecticut Clean Energy Power Plant explosion killed 5 workers while the plant was still being built. The Norco oil refinery explosion killed 7 workers. The Bankuo hydro dam failure killed 26,000 people immediately, and around 200,000 more died over the next few months. The Abafan colliery spill tip collapse killed 116 schoolchildren. Compared to any of these, Fukushima was a small lost time incident. So why has Fukushima caused such consternation? For several weeks, pundits have been speculating on what might have happened, or what might happen next, with little consideration for the evidence for what actually has happened. Now, there's nothing wrong with speculation. There's nothing wrong with thinking about what the worst possible outcome is. The trouble is, Fukushima gives us no new information about the risks of nuclear power. We have learned nothing about what the worst likely outcome is, because we have no new evidence that severe outcomes are actually likely. If anything, Fukushima is yet another data point which indicates the success of safety in the nuclear industry. Fukushima 2 was hit by the same tsunami and earthquake as Fukushima 1 and successfully shut down. Fukushima 1, with all the odds stacked against it, managed to survive with only minor leaks of radiation. There is some evidence to suggest that small amounts of radioactive isotopes have entered the surrounding area. But just because these are radioactive does not make them any worse than any other carcinogenic chemicals released by any other industry, including the chemical and gas power plant fires that have occurred in other places in Japan as a consequence of the earthquakes. So what have we actually learned? Well, we know that in the event of a major accident, we're not going to trust information coming from the company. It doesn't actually matter whether the company is trustworthy or not. It's foreseeable that we aren't going to believe what we hear from them. Our emergency planning needs to take this into account. We have also learned something about the speed of accidents. Our previous assumption was that disasters happen quickly and that emergency response is all about coping with the aftermath. In both Deepwater Horizon and Fukushima, there was ongoing risk of further harm for a considerable period after the initial events became public. In the case of Deepwater Horizon, this was because of the ongoing oil release. In the case of Fukushima, it was because of the inevitable release of decay heat after shutdown. Slow-motion disasters are not new. Oil well fires in the past have burnt for months, and coal seam fires can last for hundreds of years, but these are considered acceptable consequences of fossil fuel production. The dread factor from Fukushima was presumably that a mostly controlled situation could suddenly explode into a wide-area, high-casualty disaster. Whilst it is undeniable that risk exists until the excess heat was fully removed from the system, this is risk of leaks and small-scale dispersal of radiation, not of catastrophe. There will also be lessons to learn about the feedback cycles inherent in media reporting of risk and of public risk perception. There is great power here, if only this power could be used for good. Join me in a rebranding campaign. Global warming doesn't seem to be so bad for the public. The real threat is capture
of solar nuclear energy.
The sun is
radioactive.
Ionizing radiation is not just bombarding us, we are trapping it here. We need to let Mother Earth get rid of it.
Toxic aromatic CO2
is a
nuclear biohazard.
This is Drew Ray reporting for the Pod Delusion.
You may remember that a few weeks ago, we covered the National Secular Society's Secularist of the Year Award ceremony. You can go back and listen to episode 77 if you'd like to hear more on that. But also speaking at the award ceremony was philosopher and the incoming British Humanist Association president, A.C. Grayling. We managed to grab a quick word with him before the ceremony, where he spoke about why secularism is important, as well as giving us a taste of his new book, which is called The Good Book, A Secular Bible, which aims to do for atheism what the Bible did to Judaism. So I guess we can look forward to centuries of war and strife as we argue over exactly what it is that Grayling meant. So let's hand over to me, speaking a few weeks ago, to Professor Grayling. So we're here with A.C. Grayling, who's presenting the awards today. Thank you for joining us.
Great pleasure.
Yes, how important do you think these awards are?
They're very important, really, because they're encouraging to people who, you know, are on the side of the secularist argument. And it advertises the fact that there are people doing very, very good work, hard work, and, you know, sometimes sort of putting their necks on the line, really, in order to carry the argument forward about how important it is that our public square, public debate, ought to be neutral with respect to all different beliefs and attitudes in society.
You're obviously heavily involved in the secularist movement, the atheist movement in general, being a rather well-known non-believer. We actually we found out yesterday that you're debating the Archbishop of Canterbury in May.
I am indeed, yes, because I'm just about to publish a secular Bible. Mm. That is a Bible made out of all the great non-religious texts of the world, which I've pinched and woven together and edited and had great fun doing. And it's a quite serious attempt to show that, in fact, there's an enormous repository of insight and wisdom and inspiration about the human condition. And that, and, you know, the way the Bible was made, it was made by lots of people taking lots of texts and, you know, messing about with them and changing them and taking out inconvenient occurrences of the word not and so on. Mm. And so I've done the same thing as a sort of competitor to the Bible. And Rowan Williams, who is sort of a friend of mine, really, he and I are going to be discussing this in May at the Royal Festival Hall.
Are you expecting things to be a polite exchange of views, or do you reckon it will get a bit fisticuffs?
Oh, no, I think it will be very polite. You know, we're both gents, but we come from completely different orientations, of course. And I think what we'll be focusing on is the importance of and repositories of ideas. Mm. The Bible, which is a word, of course, that Christians use in order to denote the Hebrew scriptures that Jewish people rely on, and the New Testament of the Christians, was for a very, very long time the only book. I mean, Biblion means book, and it was the only one available, and very few people could read it, and so they read out their selected passages from it. And it had a big influence on European society for about 1,000 years. And liberation from a single book has been important. But it's also important that people should have a resource. So those of us who are not religious, those of us who've had the opportunity to live near libraries and to have an education, would know where to go if we wanted to look into the philosophical and ethical debates that humankind has had with itself. Lots of people in the world don't have that opportunity, which is why putting it all together in a single Biblion, but this time for non-religious folks, it seemed to me important to do.
So, apart from your own book, which books and writers do you think are most important to the sort of secular cause? Liz is a scholar of secular history. From what she's told me, tried to dumb down so I can understand, each of these, all the secularists, the humanists and the atheists, all derive their philosophy, their worldviews from different traditions.
Yes.
Which are most important to you?
Well, I mean, there are a number of different major traditions, and I suppose the one that I've drawn on most heavily is the tradition beginning in classical antiquity in classical Athens, really, all the way through to the 3rd, 4th century AD, which is the point in history at which Christianity became the dominant ideology in Europe. So that's 1,000 years of thinking in the classical tradition, nearly, about ethics, about the good society, about how people should live together. And when people look back at that and they see the Stoics making reference to the Logos and so on, they think that this is a forerunner of what we think of as religion. But the young religions, Christianity and Islam in particular, and also to some extent Judaism, because that's in human historical terms, but they're very young religions, the idea of a personal deity modelled on the monarch whom everybody has to obey, that's a very different conception of religion. You know, this sort of private imaginary friend you've got that you can talk to in bed at night. That's a very new thing in human history. And when you look at, let us say, Roman religion, the word religion coming from the Latin religio, religere, which means to bind, to bring together, it was a communal thing. It was for social cohesion. And people didn't go off and have their little private prayers. So when you look at the ethics of the New Testament, where it says, you know, give everything away and turn your back on your family and don't marry and make no plans, and you recognize this is the unlivable ethics of a people who thought the end of the world was genuinely, sincerely, they thought it was coming very soon. And when they found that it wasn't coming all that soon, they had to go to this great resource of classical philosophy and ethical thinking, which is what I put in my book.
Interesting. We'll wrap things up there. Anthony Grayley, thank you very much.
Great pleasure.
Quickly, when's the book out? Let's make some money. When can people get their hands on the book?
It's actually published on the 3rd of April.
The 3rd of April?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Not on the 1st of April, you know. Just.
Anthony Grayley, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Cheers. The American Humanist Association are also holding an award ceremony this weekend, and picking up their Humanist of the Year award is a novelist and philosopher, Rebecca Goldstein. She recently wrote the book 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a work of fiction. And recently she spoke to Liz Luckendorf about why it was indeed a work of fiction. My guess would be because it's got made-up characters and stories and stuff in it. But here's Liz with more.
Rebecca Goldstein is a philosopher by trade and training, but also a novelist and nonfiction writer. Her subjects cover the interplay between intelligence and emotion, but also the lives of mathematician Kurt Gödel and philosopher Benedict Spinoza. Her most recent novel, 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a work of fiction, is about Cass Seltzer, an atheist with a soul. Cass becomes famous as a new atheist after publishing his book called The Varieties of Religious Illusion, and Goldstein's novel fluctuates between his present and past as a graduate student. This month, Goldstein is the recipient of the Humanist of the Year Award by the American Humanist Association. I had the good fortune to have a chat with her about her work and views on secularism. So I guess the first question would be, what inspired you to write this book?
I go back and forth between fiction and nonfiction. I'm a trained philosopher, you know, have been a professor of philosophy for most of my life. The last book I had written had been nonfiction, and it was on the philosopher Spinoza. And I got swept up into organized non-religion. It was sort of interesting to discover, at least in the U.S., I don't know about the U.K., there are a lot of groups, secular groups, secular humanism, free thinking, and I just got many, many invitations for them, and that was a bit of a revelation to me that there were all of these organizations, and I found the whole movement fascinating, and I found sometimes I got upset when I was speaking to people with whom I completely agreed intellectually, but the emotions that they were expressing sometimes upset me. And I began to think about a way to write about religion that could and secularism and this current extraordinarily active debate going on right now. Not been anything quite like it since the European Enlightenment in the 17th and 18th century. You know, I wanted to write about it in a way that could do justice to all of the emotions in this debate, not just the intellectual arguments and arguments about, you know, God or not or all of that, but the other things as well. And whenever I start thinking like that, I start thinking about fiction. It always happens to me. Against my best intentions that I will just stick to straight philosophy, I'm thinking about the emotions, and suddenly characters will start coming to me who embody these conflicts.
You mentioned being invited to some of the new atheist type events. What do you think about the movement in general?
This question of, you know, why is it important? I think that one of the reasons that many people remain within religious communities, even when they are themselves skeptical or don't even really think about the theism all that much, is that they want a community. That they go to church, synagogue, and mosque, you know, for the community. And I myself was brought up in a very religious community and household, and for me it was wonderful to escape that community and an enforced kind of community. But I know that people vary very much emotionally in so many different ways, and for some people they need this sort of thing. And some of the people I've met at these things are people who, you know, had been belonged to some Christian or Jewish group, and then progress to through universalists or ethical culture, or and then, you know, even that was too much religion for them, and they went the next step to another organization. But I think, you know, there's fellowship to be found there, fellowship of like-minded people whose values you appreciate and trust. And I think also, you know, as a kind of presence and as a kind of pushback to the awful, pernicious, despicable thing that one often hears, which is that without theism, there can be no morality, which is just, you know, philosophically erroneous and politically and morally, you know, monstrous, because it's saying terrible thing about false and malicious things about citizens.
One of the main settings for the novel is a strict Jewish community of New Alden, where one of the main characters is a boy called Azaria, who will one day become the leader of the community, as is their custom. However, he is also a mathematical genius, and Cass takes an interest in him. It's a very interesting source of tension in the book. I was especially fascinated by the community of New Walden. Was that entirely fiction, or based on a community in the U.S.?
Yeah, it is, and there really was... I come from an Orthodox background, but it wasn't that extreme. We didn't live in a community where there were different sidewalks for the men and women. That came as a shock to me, you know. And it really was, you know, we're walking down the street, and we don't see any men. Then we discover they're all, you know, in this massive, massive synagogue. It was like a warehouse. It was thousands of people packed in. But, you know, we're seeing these Yiddish signs, and we're trying to make them out there. And then we asked a woman, you know, what does it say? And she's, you know, very sweetly said, well, it means that he, pointing to Steve, is supposed to be walking on that sidewalk, and you, pointing to me and my daughter, are supposed to be on this sidewalk. So, yeah, that was amazing to us, even to me, you know, coming from a fairly Orthodox background.
The main character of your novel is Cass Seltzer, the atheist with a soul. Do you think most atheists are typecast as kind of Dawkins-esque, or are we all more like Cass?
I think there's a great spectrum, don't you? I mean, I've noticed, you know, there's been, just as I find in religion, you know, that the religion will often, of the particular person will be expressive, how it comes out will be very expressive of their underlying nature. Are they sweet and tolerant, as my father was, or intolerant and full of condemnation of those who don't share their point of view? You know, there are the really angry people, and then there are the less, you know, and not angry, but you know, full of a kind of joy in existence.
And to just finish off, do you have any other books or projects planned in the future?
I am under contract for a book, and it's supposed to be on Plato, who was my first philosophical love. I found him when I was very young. So it's going to be Plato in dialogue with thinkers through the ages, you know, the dialogue as homage to Plato's own form of writing. You know, Plato, in dialogue with people like George Eliot, for example, over the use of the imagination. Plato had no use for it. He thought it had no intellect, no philosophical merits, or he was divided on it, but especially narrative imagination. And Plato in dialogue with Orwell on democracy, and, you know, people who disagreed with Plato very much.
Okay, I think that's a good place to end. Thank you so much for your time.
Okay, it's my pleasure.
36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a Work of Fiction, by Rebecca Goldstein is available at many bookstores if this interview has tickled anyone's fancy. The full uncut version of this interview can also be found at the Pod Delusion Extra Feed. This has been Liz Lustendorf for The Pod Delusion.
Now, have you ever thought about donating your body to medical science? That's what Alex Foster has been doing this week. By which I mean he's not dead yet, he's just been thinking about it. But it's an interesting story nonetheless. So here he is, with more.
Hello, my name is Alex Foster, and you may recall me from such Pod Delusion interventions as Pod Delusion Live last year, where I explained why it is that I am prepared to donate my vital organs and bone marrow, but am not allowed to give blood. This week, I have been musing over another type of donation entirely. Don't worry, it's not sperm, although perhaps one day I will relate the story of a friend who has been through the process. It's not nearly as straightforward or enjoyable as you might imagine. But as you might have gathered, if you're squeamish or eating right now, you might want to come back to this contribution later on. For this week, I'm thinking about donating my body to medical science. I googled the details and my city name and have in front of me the forms I need to set the process going. After that, all that remains for me to do is die, preferably not of trauma or infectious disease, which would mean they would not accept my body regardless of my wishes. And it's an either-or kind of scenario. If I die in one of the rare ways that means my organs can be harvested, medical science would not be interested in the bits that remain after transplant surgeons have distributed the useful bits to those unfortunate enough to be in need of them. I had been a little bit bothered about what to do with my body after I stopped using it. Neither burial nor cremation really sounded quite right for me. I'm not so vain that I think there will be anyone beating a path to my shrine after I'm gone, and the worms are a bit icky, so no burial. and even though I'm a closet pyromaniac, the chapels at crematoria are just so horrid. Almost no one in my family has opted for burial in recent years, so it's been decades since I was last graveside, and that was to put Great Aunt Mary in the ground. She gets to spend eternity right next to my late step-great-grandmother. The two barely spoke to each other in life, so the family appreciates the irony of leaving them to not talk to each other until the final trumpet. I live in Nottingham, so the people who'd get my earthly remains would be the Queen's Medical Centre, where, by and large, they would be used by students in the medical school. Hell, I'm an arts graduate, so I only have a dim idea of what goes on in medical school thanks to Grey's Anatomy and Scrubs, but I'm sure they'll be respectful and get a good use out of whatever I can leave behind, whenever that ends up being. Whilst my academic pursuits were constrained by my choice to do modern languages at A-level, two family members have followed medical routes, so I'm dimly aware of a debate going on in medical science about whether it's still necessary to use real cadavers in training those going on to medical professions. One of them trained as a chiropodist in the late 80s and learned anatomy from an actual dead guy's feet. Feet look so simple, you know, and that there are a lot of things going on down there. There's 26 bones, for starters, or so Google tells me, which account for a quarter of the bones in your body. Still, in his training, my chiropodist relative told us at the time, and the description was vivid enough to stay with me all these years, it wasn't the dead guy's feet that bothered him most. He'd been studying feet for years and knew what to expect. No, what troubled him most was that the dentists had got to the body first, and they didn't leave much left in the way of faces or jaws. Wind forward a decade or so, and when my next relative entered medical school in training to be a full-on doctor, not a specialist in extremities, he selected a fancy modern medical school that had decided that dissection was not necessary for most students planning to end up as doctors. It might be ultra-relevant for those few of them specialising in surgery, but for the vast majority it simply wasn't worth the expense or the time it takes away from the sorts of medical skills that you will need every day and can only practice on living patients, like intubation, cannulation and phlebotomy. Every once in a while I'm present in a room when a medical student whose practice included dissection gets to meet someone who's training without. Suffice it to say, it always seems to result in a debate that hasn't been resolved. Doctors of some standing struggle to imagine how training could be complete without it, but modernisers point out there are whole branches of the doctor training experience that have changed radically in the last 10 years. Why stop at dissection? According to the internet, Cardiff, Sheffield, Bristol, Leeds, Warwick, Brighton, King's, UCL, Imperial, Nottingham and Glasgow all still have medical schools teaching anatomy through dissection, while Southampton, Liverpool, Newcastle, Birmingham and Queen Mary Westfield have taken it off the syllabus. All of them are throwing out qualified doctors at a rate of hundreds a year, and once they've been in practice a few years, you'd never know the difference. And I'm not nearly qualified enough to weigh in on which are the better doctors, no matter how much ER I've been watching this month. This whole set of musings about dead bodies was kicked off by my reading Mary Roach's Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, a book I would heartily recommend to anyone. Roach has a light touch when writing about science, meaning her books are eminently accessible to those of us without scientific training, but who are interested in her subjects. She tends to choose areas of research where the practitioners are faintly embarrassed by the work they do. The consequence is a book you are faintly embarrassed to be reading. Despite having finished Bonk, her book about research into sex and reproduction, some months ago, I've still not found anyone I quite dare lend it to. Stiff, the book about corpses, is a romp through the uses of dead bodies, both contemporary and historical. It begins with use in medical teaching and gets a whole lot more weird as it continues, through the use of dead bodies as crash test dummies. What's the use of actual crash test dummies recording forces inflicted on dummies if you don't know how much force it takes to actually break a bone? Weirder, it takes in the body farm, familiar to readers of Patricia Cornwell, where they study the science of putrescence. And weirdest of all, it considers the use of real dead people mashed up into medicines to try and heal the living. No, seriously. That last use of dead bodies gives rise to one of the most fascinating quotes in the book. It wasn't until about 1920 that the average patient with the average illness seeing the average physician came off better for the encounter. My only experience of seeing a dead body myself was via Gunther von Hagen's excellent exhibition, Body Worlds, which takes people who have their bodies for display after a process called plastination. If you ever have the opportunity to see this, go, and if you possibly can, take a medic with you. I went with the relative who didn't get to do dissection, and he was fascinated and pointed out all sorts of things I'd have missed if he'd not been there. For example, I basically understood the links between bones and blood. Your long bones make your white blood cells, for example. But until I was shown the holes, I never really realised that bones have a blood supply. Body Worlds is currently touring the US with stops in San Jose, Chicago and Arizona. There's also a permanent exhibition in Germany. If you're nearby, go and see it. You even get to see a guy with his nads hanging out. And not in the good way.
Finally this week, Salim Fadli has been talking to perhaps the ultimate internet troll. She managed to collectively upset almost the entirety of the internet in mere hours a few weeks ago by posting a video thanking God for the earthquake and tsunami in Japan. Needless to say that she got some flack for it. But why did she do it? Personally, if I were an internet troll, I'd just stick to the less controversial things like shouting homophobic abuse at people over Xbox Live or being James Dellingpole. Here's Salim Fadli with more.
Perhaps you've seen a YouTube video of a young woman ecstatically thanking God for the earthquake in Japan. It was one of the most viewed videos on YouTube in the week of the disaster. To jog your memory, here is a clip of the video, followed by an interview with its creator.
God is such an amazing God. He is so good and so loving, and God shook the country of Japan. He literally grabbed the country by the shoulders and said, "Hey, look, I'm here." Oh, it's just so amazing to see how God can just answer prayers like this. And I am just so overjoyed and so encouraged. For the rest of this Lentil season, I'm going to be praying even harder than I have ever before.
Okay, well, my name is Tam. I'm a college student. I'm 22 years old, and I teach piano. I give music lessons.
For the past few months, you've been running a very popular YouTube channel in which you play the part of a borderline insane fundamentalist Christian who says the craziest things to her webcam. And recently, you put out a video which went completely viral ballistic. Can you talk about that?
I recorded a video basically where my character was parroting what a lot of mainstream Christian leaders, pastors, icons would have said regarding any kind of natural disaster. But this one was directed towards the earthquake that hit Japan.
When I first saw that video on the front page of Richard Dawkins's website, my first thought was, is this woman for real? Fellow Pod Delusion contributor Paul Day and myself, we went through the entire collection of videos on your YouTube channel. And by the end of the process, we were 95% sure that you were doing this for laughs. But there was always that little frisson of doubt. Why do you think that doubt is so important for good satire?
Because no matter how crazy someone sounds, there's always going to be someone out there who is even crazier, but being completely honest in what they're saying.
So that, for me, is the important truth. And it also explains why the videos you produce are so funny. You've essentially distilled down all the crazy that's out there, and you've put them into the voice of a single fictional character. And when you distill it down into such a concentrated formula, it's so offensive, it's so outrageous. You can't help but notice that. But maybe a lot of people obviously don't notice that it's offensive when Pat Robertson or Glenn Beck say these things.
The problem is when people like Glenn Beck or Pat Robertson say the exact same thing, they sugarcoat it and they add in a lot of theology and dogma and a lot of keywords like Bible and God. And they use a lot of scare tactics. They definitely use people's fear to their own advantage. And when you take all of that out, what's left is just a horrible, nasty mess of garbage, really.
Yes, when you strip away the fancy presentation, but you say essentially the same thing, you really do reveal the essential awfulness of the message. And I think it sounds doubly awful because people just don't expect to hear such words coming from the mouth of a young woman.
Right. And that's another thing about my character. She was supposed to be the epitome of what a blind follower of these people would sound like.
Well, she's actually pretty much the same as Megan Phelps, the daughter-in-law of Pastor Fred Phelps of Westboro Baptist.
The difference between Megan Phelps and Tam Tam Pamela, though, is that Megan Phelps, you know, she's part of a specific group, whereas my character, Tam Tam Pamela, was kind of latched on to all these higher up religious leaders under the broad umbrella of Christianity.
You've actually assimilated the mindset of the authoritarian follower. And, you know, actually, so these guys tend not to think so carefully about how they assemble a coherent worldview. They simply grab prepackaged worldviews from the figures of authority they trust, such as Glenn Beck and Pat Robertson.
I hate to say it, but they don't actually think and rationalize for themselves. They just regurgitate whatever is being fed to them.
Not everybody reacted to your performance with the same unhinged glee that I did. Some people got very angry.
I find this video extremely offensive, and I really hope it gets taken down as soon as possible.
But how are you excited that hundreds and thousands of people died? Am I reading the wrong Bible here? Like, what?
I have never been this angry about a religious person before.
You're fine with the fact that the way he went about doing that is killing thousands and thousands of innocent people?
Don't let the trolls win. She's obviously faking it, just to get a reaction out of everyone. And she's succeeding wonders.
Yeah, I was getting death threats, threats of raping me to death. One person actually put a bounty on my head. He offered $1,000 to the first person who would kill me, and people were sending pizzas to my house.
Presumably they hadn't first paid for them. They were expecting you to pay for the pizzas, weren't they?
Right. They would place the order and have it delivered to my house. And they were really disgusting pizzas, too. Like, no cheese, no sauce, extra sausage. Like, who eats that?
Pizzas aside, the big irony here is that we have people who would probably think of themselves as fairly liberal, compassionate sort of people, who yet think it's perfectly okay to make a threat of rape against a person who's probably a comedian, for simply doing a joke they don't like.
Well, I mean, regardless of the person being a comedian or not, you know, people are entitled to their own opinions. If you don't like what someone's saying, don't listen to them.
The American Taliban would simply like to shut down every single dissenting voice. We should really aspire to something a little bit more tolerant than that.
Of course.
I think you set a record for the most dislikes on a single YouTube video. At the last count, before your God is Great video was shut down, you were in the 300,000s. So I think that makes you a kind of anti-Lady Gaga. Congratulations are definitely in order. But when can we expect to see more stuff from Tam Tam Pamela?
Tam Tam Pamela has pretty much been martyred for the cause. I think that character will definitely be put to rest. But I myself, I don't plan on stopping. I do plan on continuing doing what it is that I do best.
Just because something is satire doesn't mean it's fake. Tam's work is funny because it's reflecting a profound truth, which is that mainstream Christians do often blame entirely natural processes of the atmosphere and earth on their God's emotions. Thanking God for another beautiful day is just the flip side of thanking God for sending a tsunami. It's shocking to learn about the threats of rape and murder that people have made against Tam. However, the irony is that millionaire televangelists routinely say exactly the same things, most notably Pat Robertson, who blamed Hurricane Katrina on homosexuality in New Orleans. The Tam haters might have a point that her humor is extreme, but their anger is entirely misplaced, since everything that she has said has already been said by famous millionaire televangelists. This is Salim Fadli for The Pod Delusion.
And that's it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen back to older episodes of the podcast, as well as follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or even find out how to get involved with the show yourself. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Sean Ellis, James Firth, Drew Ray, Liz Luckendorf, Alex Foster, Salim Fadli, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf, because my kidney was lasered yesterday, so I haven't been entirely focused. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
I just sound like a homeopath, but this is like looking at the whole of the patient, as it were, rather than surgery. So good metaphor, but the wrong one.